welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
And I introduced our guest, Robert Tannenbaum, last hour when I was supposed to...
I tried to tell you that was all wrong, but you wouldn't listen.
Oh, I did the whole thing, too. It was really great. And then the guy says, hey, by the way...
That's not me.
So, Robert, this is just kind of the spoiler alert here. it's been like that kind of an afternoon.
No, you guys are too well known for anything like that.
Oh, what a bunch of goofballs. Good grief. So, you know, just I don't know, I can't do a short form. You have a really fun bio. When they sent me this, I was like,
you need to read.
They're like, hey, do you want to interview me? Yeah, we do. So your book, one of, let's see, what is it? 33, 29 are novels, 4 are nonfiction. Yeah, you should come back and tell us about the nonfiction because I'm kind of excited about those. But this current book is That Day in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald Did Not Kill JFK. And I thought, well, how timely, since we're all learning new things. So you have the distinguished, history, I guess, of being one of the most successful prosecuting attorneys, having never lost a felony trial. So hundreds of violent criminals. It says here hundreds. Do you know how many?
I can tell you this. For 10 years, when I was working as an assistant district attorney in the office of legendary D.A. Frank Hogan in Manhattan, I tried, on the average, at least 2 cases a month, and that's very conservative. So you can do the math on that. That's why I don't come up with any numbers. But
sure,
the only person who's ever prosecuted more cases than I did, I will tell you, was Richard Sprague, who was the chief assistant D.A. in Philadelphia, and who asked me to go to Washington in October of 76, when he became chief counsel to the Select Committee on Assassinations, and he wanted me to take over the Kennedy investigation. So I was his deputy chief counsel, solely investigating the assassination of President Kennedy.
Wow. Well,
that had to be a real eye opener. I mean, some of the stuff you came across, and you know, why so much of it wasn't.
Well,
it was known, but they just wouldn't release it.
Yeah, but he was. Before we delve in, because we'll never delve out. You know how that goes. The time runs away with us. But you were not only deputy chief counsel for the Congressional Committee investigation into President John F. Kennedy's assassination, but also Dr. Martin Luther King. And I'm sure that there is a huge story on that we won't make you tell this time, but we may force you to come back. And then in your free time, you were the mayor of Beverly Hills, so I think that's kind of a fun little...
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. But when I was in the DA's office, what's interesting is the issue you're touching upon. I'm in the DA's office for 10 years, and I was in charge ultimately of the Homicide Bureau, and I was the chief of the criminal courts. And every day we got 250 new cases into that office, my office. And we try to deal with what, you know, we call quality, what I call quality dispositions. You just can't try everything, but you don't want to plea bargain away serious cases either. So you're like, I created what has been used was the notion that there are certain cases that should never be plea bargained. But if the defendant, every defendant has the right to plead to the top count of an indictment. And if that's what they want to do, then they do it, and the DA then can speak on sentence, as well as the defense putting in mitigation and the prosecution putting in aggravation. So that experience, the reason I mention it is, that was what I was hit with when I started the investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy with Dick Sprague from Philly. And we worked for 3.5 months, you know, nonstop. And with him and I, with him and me, there was no ever a Saturday or a Sunday kind of thing. We knew we were up against the clock. But the other thing that was terribly distressing was, which is the reason why we resigned, was we got a commitment from the committee members they would not interfere with our committee politically. And as soon as it all boiled down, I was asking for information, which I'll go into with you if you wish, on the CIA's participation, alleged participation in the assassination. And I have known from various sources that there were documents that the CIA had indicating that, in fact, they had, in fact, gotten involved in the assassination, which they called the Dallas Action at the time. And that and the people working in the CIA, and this comes in from a letter, from the head of the CIA, John McCone, in March 3rd, 64, that members of the CIA participated in the assassination. And I wanted to get the documents to see whether this was a CIA operation or was a rogue operation. And that's when Lou Stokes, who was chairman of the committee, good man, he wasn't going to go, as he said, quote, to the mattresses for me. I said, you're not doing anything for me. I'm working here for the Congress. And from what I'm hearing, if you're not going to give me my subpoena power, then Sprague and I, I can only speak for myself at the moment, are wasting our time, and you're violating the major commitment that you made to us that you wouldn't interfere. And now we're at the brink of it, and you're interfering. You're tying our hands. So he says, what do you want to do about that, Bob? He was a classic criminal defense attorney in Cleveland. His brother, Carl, was the first black mayor of Cleveland. And he was a good man. And we became lifelong friends from this because he said to me, the majority of the committee is not going to support you anymore. I said, why are you hiring me? I told you not to hire me because I'm never going to, in any fashion, compromise on search for truth. And, the Congress can only move forward on search, on compromise. But I'm not going to do that. So, I'm probably the wrong person for you. And that's when they said, we're not going to interfere with you. I said, okay. 3.5 months later, they totally interfered. And then when Lou asked me in his office, when he told me they wouldn't honor the subpoenas, he said, what are you going to do? And I just looked at him right eye to eye and said, I'm resigning effective right now. And I'm going to meet with Dick within the hour, Dick Sprague. And I can't tell you what an incredibly wonderful person Sprague is. Honest, a brilliant trial lawyer. And there were few I would say that about in the country. So having done what I did as a prosecutor for 10 years, working for working in the DA's office for Hogan, it's a big part of my book. I mean, that day in Dallas really in part is a memoir with respect to how I formed my value system. And there are anecdotal details which I have never, ever told anybody about, frankly. Not that anybody might be interested, but you know how we think about things that affected us and how that moved us, hopefully, in the right direction. And, it's sort of like an interventionist kind of argument. Either that or you believe in incredible coincidences. So, leave it as it may. I just present this. I present this in the book in that fashion, that this is what I experienced. I'm not talking about anybody else. We're telling them how to live their life, believe me. I'm the last person to tell anybody that. But I'm just saying that in the book, which makes it very different, is a section on how I formed my value system. And the reason for it is I wanted people in that day in Dallas who reading this book to know who I am. I mean, I'm not some crazy character wandering around creating unnecessary conspiracies. And the evidence in this case is overwhelming, which I will go into with you as you wish. And I'm just amazed that others haven't picked up on it. The things they picked up on, and there are a lot of people who are involved in the conspiracy arguments. Many of them are good people. But they're not involved in the justice system. They don't know the justice system.
Right.
That doesn't mean they can't speak about the truth of the justice system. But they're not into that sort of thing. And what they wind up is in issues where they're two coffins, for example. What the hell does that have to do with who killed the president?
Yeah.
And that's why I think this is the most important case in criminal justice, because we don't know who killed President Kennedy. We know about the terrible disaster of American history with Abe Lincoln getting murdered. But we don't know who murdered the president. And that's why I finally, after all these years, decided the time had come to tell the story. There's no way. I want the truth to come out on this thing.
When they started to interfere, where was the pressure coming from? I mean, who was kind of behind all
that? You should probably ask who wasn't pressuring him.
Well, the CIA were the operatives here. They did not want to see the following take place, which was happening. In the Bay of Pigs invasion, as you know, in 61, Kennedy fired Alan Dulles as head of the CIA. And he put in John McCone, who was very much a pro JFK person. I mention that because McCone wrote a letter, which is amazing to me. I call it a letter. It could be called a memo. And he wrote it in response to James Rowley, who was the chief of the Secret Service. And Rowley was concerned about these leaks that were going on about Lee Harvey Oswald. And the leaks were about his training, his suspect activity, And it exceeded what they thought the CIA would do in that regard. And they, because they became, they become operational. And they had their own foreign policy and they had their own military. And there was no oversight. I mean, the best example of the lack of oversight was the incredible senator from New York who said when Trump went after the CIA a little, you know, to calm them down or whatever it was that he was criticizing, Schumer said, gee, how smart can this guy be? He's talking about the President of the United States. When they are 6 ways and 10 ways to Sunday, whatever the number was, they'll get back at you. This is a guy in charge of oversight in the United States Senate. They're going to get back at you.
Wow.
And because, yeah. I said to Stokes, why are you doing this? Why aren't more people saying, you know, we have here a potential coup of murder? And what do you say? Pass the potatoes? It's okay? I don't get it. There's like some kind of cleavage here, if you will, of why people are sort of accepting this. But anyway, in this memo letter I was mentioning to you a moment ago from John McCain, now head of the CIA, he said they were worried about these leaks in the letter. It's a two-page letter with third page is a signature page. And then paragraph 6 is so incriminating. You asked me as a trial lawyer, you know, if you had a dream about a great piece of evidence, here it is in large measure. And he said that in substance, he said that he was worried about information that was in any way, that any way would disclose to the wrong persons. It would lead the media to erroneously claim that this agency, the CIA, and perhaps others more directly involved in the Dallas action, again, that's how he referred to the assassination. And he says, while the persons involved were in the employ of the CIA, that is the assassination of the President of the United States, as well as the FBI, he says in his note, Dr. James Riley, and again, that's March 3rd, 64. The persons, he says, while the persons involved were in the employ of the CIA, as well as the FBI, it's impossible for us to maintain full 24-hour day responsibility over its operatives. That was his explanation for the murder of the President. I mean, when you get a piece of evidence like this, with all due respect, seriously, I tell you, you look up heavenly and you say, thank you, God, I can take over from here.
No kidding.
So, I mean, that's the effect of trying all these cases, believe me. And I loved every second of it, and I explain why in the book, which I think is... You would find interesting. I would hope you would at least. And I again wanted the public to know why was I such a fanatic about preparation and about trying all these cases. I will tell you this: two detectives were assigned to me, two outstanding detectives from New York PD, and they made me look good. Believe me when I tell you this. We worked nonstop around the clock together. And one of them moved in with my family, lived with us for 14 years. And the other one had the same access. So it was Don Basler and Cliff Fenton. Cliff Fenton grew up in Harlem on 50th Street all his life, 150th rather. And Basler was in charge of what we called Manhattan South, which was south, everything south of 59th Street. And when I say, you know, I tried, yeah, I did try, but I tried it with evidence that was immutable. What is that? That we're talking now. Evidence is immutable that we're talking now. That's the kind of evidence I'm talking about that cannot be refuted. It's scientific, it's audio, it's visual, it's acoustics in this particular case. And because the witnesses there thought they had nothing really to say because they couldn't identify anybody, but they had a lot to say about what happened at Dealey Plaza. And that's something that we should go into about what the real evidence is and what happened. And it's shocking. It's very shocking. It was shocking to me, I will tell you, you know, coming out of the DA's office the way I did, in charge of, you know, the homicide bureau, as I said, and in charge of the criminal courts. So the whole experience has been... you know, one of total revelation, and that's why I think it's important.
Well, there is so much that has come out over the years about this, and so much of it is so just tedious. You know, it's kind of like, yeah, there was a flashing light, somebody saw somebody. It just isn't well It isn't laid out. It isn't laid out like a court case, and I think that's the absolute difference in the material that I think you'll bring. We should tell people that this book is being released May 20th, 2025, so we're slightly ahead of the game because we're airing live on April 6th. So after May, if we need an archive, we will pull this and play it again, but I don't know, you know, I do want to hear all of those things that you found. How about we take a really quick break? We'll come right back, and we will hear more from our guest. The book is That Last Day in Dallas, Lee Harvey Oswald Did Not Kill JFK, and the author is Robert K. Tannenbaum. And we have him as our hostage here at We the People Radio.
.us.
I'm with you.
I'm gonna do bad things, do it like it's nothing. Being bad has never felt so good. I'm gonna do bad things, you won't see it coming. What you said, I've been thinking of doing bad things to you.
I was born, six gun in my hand, behind a gun.
Unceremonious ending there. I guess I better fix my clip, my song clip. Didn't fade out like I chose. Kind of funny though. I mean, you start thinking about, gosh, what kind of music will we play for this this program? That seemed fitting.
Yeah.
So
when you pick the, as far as I'm concerned, you picked the winner. So
yeah, it was kind of a given in a way. Kind of
so,
right.
So Robert, I'm really curious. You know, they're starting to release more evidence. I'm not sure they're releasing all of it, but how much of the information that they're now releasing is going to substantiate what's in your book? Because obviously, your book came out or was written before this week.
That's for sure.
I forgot about that.
Took me several years to write this book, believe me. And all of that is explained in the book, why it took so long. But the bottom line here is really the following. The CIA's role is so pernicious in so many different areas. And that's why it's important to talk about the John McCone letter. So, you know, as I mentioned, the CIA operative, the chief of the CIA, saying that the people in this agency participated in the assassination of the president. That's quite a statement to make.
Yeah.
And then the truth about what happened at Dealey Plaza is very important. I'll go through that with you because it's an indication of how the witnesses, when you talk to witnesses, they don't always say, I saw Smith with the loaded pistol smoking and so on, and the deceased at his feet. And here's a perfect example of it all at Dealey Plaza, what I call the truth at Dealey Plaza. All of this, with all of my exhibits, are in the book, that is in my book, That Day in Dallas. And anyway, here it goes. The shots that were fired at Dealey Plaza were five in numbers that we can trace, not three. Because keep in mind, the government's position, having been lying to the American public for the last 62 years, has been there were three shots fired. One hit Kennedy in the back in the first flurry, and then one hit Kennedy in the top of his head and caused his head to go forward. And Oswald did it, and he did it alone. That's their case. And the case is an embarrassment, and I'll explain why right now. By the way, in direct answer to your first question, the JFK Records Act, as I'm sure you know, was in 1992. And that was because of various films that were being made and so on the revelations of what was going on. And then there was called, in 1993, the Assassinations Record Review Board. And at that time, they asked me to give testimony, and I did. And I said, give over everything you have and do it as fast as you can. because there's no way on planet Earth would it offend your common sense if I suggested to you that the CIA has been lying about this case for all these years. And I structure my book on this issue. I structure my book as if I'm trying the case. So what I've done here is indict and charge, if you will, in literature, I should say, those who have lied to us for all these years, and to exonerate those who spoke truth to power. And that's what this book is all about. So when I said to them, give everything over, it was because of the CIA's involvement in this whole story. And I'll give you a quick anecdote on that. Three people went to see the CB to show you the culture of what we're talking about. And three people went to see Chief Justice Warren. Keep in mind, Earl Warren was a former Attorney General of California. He was a political person, and he was immersed in various criminal justice issues. And the three people were Henry Wade, DA of Dallas, Wagner Carr, the Attorney General, and Leon Jaworski, who we came to know 10 years later. He was a lawyer for Wagner Carr, the Attorney General. And they said to the Chief Justice on the record at executive session that, based upon our information, Lee Harvey Oswald worked for both the CIA and the FBI. Keep in mind how paranoid the government was to let the public know, which they didn't want them to know, anything about Oswald working for the government. And that started in 57 in a Tsukhi Air Force Base, where he was monitoring U-2 flights. And so what happened here was the Chief Justice said, oh, we'll investigate that. Not so fast, said Alan Dulles. What do you mean, said the Chief Justice? All of this is on the record. And the Chief Justice said, and Alan Dulles said, well, if you ask J. Edgar Hoover whether or not Oswald worked for him, they'll say, I'll check the records. He's never worked for us. He's a lone nut. That's what he'll say. And that's what he's been saying. And he's, solved the case right away in the first couple of weeks. And the Chief Justice then looked at him and said, are you telling me that if I called an agent in here under oath, he would lie to me?
Mm-hmm.
This is the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court. I mean, it's incredible. and Alan Dulles said, if he were a good agent, he would. If he were a good agent, he would. And so the Chief Justice said, well, who will we tell the truth to? Maybe the president. Now, that is an anecdotal story about the culture.
We named an airport after that guy.
Well, here we are. I mean, yeah, exactly. Exactly. And, yeah, and J. Edgar Hoover has his name on a building in D.C. It's an outrage. And the other quick one on culture is the following. And that is that at page 37, you get your hands on this, it's worth looking at, the Forensic Medical Panel report dated around August of 78. Remember, the select committees have a two-year life. They're not like the standing committees that get refunded all the time. So near the end of summer of 78, the following was put into the record at page 37 of this report, because all these reports were now the persons who took over for Sprague and me. The first things they did were hire all CIA operatives. And in this report, there's the following comment that's made. And it is that the Parkland doctors must have been mistaken about looking at the evulsive head wound. That evulsive head wound was the fourth shot that blew JFK's head off. And so they're saying in this throwaway line that the Parkland doctors must be mistaken regarding the evulsive head wound, because all 26 witnesses at Bethesda during the autopsy didn't see the head wound injury. Well, here's the kicker.
Wow.
Not only did they see the injury, they reported it under oath to the House Select Committee.
Wow.
Now, think of trying a case when you have this kind of evidence. But let's go quickly to the Dealey Plaza truth issue, because it's interesting that what witnesses tell us, you have to digest it. They don't always say the same things that we want to hear necessarily, want to hear with respect to evidence, that is. There were five shots, not three. They came in two flurries. The first flurry had three shots. The witnesses said there were first two or three shots. And it happened very quickly. What they didn't know was we would have the scientific immutable evidence issue on scientific audio and visual acoustics, what I mentioned initially. That's what the immutable facts are based on here. So what we know is that there was three shots, and they took 2.6 seconds. Now, they didn't know it took 2.6 seconds, the witnesses, but what did they say? It happened very quickly. And then one of the shots hit Kennedy in the back with a downward declination. It had a downward track, which is critical in this whole case of the nonsense of the single bullet theory. That track, that is a downward track, and just so everybody understands what I'm saying is, the bullet came in at about 6 inches, approximately 6 inches below the neckline. Keep in mind, this one bullet theory rests on the fact that the bullet came out his throat and caused damage to Connolly, struck his rib, and then fractured his axial nerve in his wrist. And so how did it get up there? It's a downward track. It's just one part of the... Well, I'll tell you how, they said. It went upward 11 degrees. That is, from the downward track, it came up vertically through his body and exited his throat. That's the essence of the single bullet theory, this nonsense. But anyway, back to the Dealey Plaza. So what happened then was there was a pause after the first shot that took 2.6 seconds. And that pause, they said, was broken up by a boom blast, which is now the fourth shot. And that we see at Zapruder frame 313. And it's all in the book. All of this evidence is in the book. And Connolly and Kennedy are hit in the back. And then we have Zapruder frame 313. And that came from the boom blast from the front by the stockade fence that the limo, the JFK limo, had not yet passed to his right. It was, the shot came from the front right that struck JFK in the temple area, right above the right ear. And this shot causes the president's head, of course, to violently snap back. You've seen this many times, I'm sure. Uh-huh. You've seen his head violently snap back and to the left, leaving him basically immobile, bodily depressed, and slumped dead on his wife's right shoulder. Now, how the CIA ignored the fact that Kennedy's head went backward violently from the shot. Why? Because logic, common sense, and science suggests that if someone came into my office right now and found me, my head would go forward. I mean, the CIA gelatinized 10 skulls, all of them in the book again, that day in Dallas. And they shot with the same distance and height that they claim Oswald shot the president. And guess what happened? All 10 skeletons, when hit from the back, went forward. Big revelation, imagine. Oh, my God. And so they then said, well, half of his face, of JFK's face, was missing as a result of the shot. Not so. In the autopsy photos I have in the book, they show miraculously JFK's face is not touched at all. And you see the back of his head, of course, was just, you know, Clint Hill, who just passed away recently, literally recently, who's a Secret Service agent, when he hit the back of that car, which slowed down to about less than 5 miles an hour and stopped and started and so on, that he saw inside the cerebellum, he saw exactly what, that there was nothing in JFK's top of his head. And Ken Clark, interestingly, who the CIA never mentions, they never put on the Parkland doctors. Imagine the Parkland doctors are these experts in trauma, and they see the body right away. And who's in charge? The chief of neurosurgery, Kemp Clark. And he said he observed a gaping hole in the back of the president's head, and it was at the lower occipital bone. And he saw the cerebellum. And then Dr. Robert McClellan drafted a vivid diagram. Again, it's in the book. You see all this stuff. And it's depicting the gaping hole in the back of the president's head. Now, here's a kicker for you on the second shooter, perhaps. Dr. Robert Shaw was the thoracic surgeon for my friend Connolly, Governor Connolly. And Shaw said that when he was talking into his microphone, as I'm talking into my cell phone right now with you, the doctors always dictate. So everything is taken down. And he did this within an hour of the assassination, Dr. Robert Shaw, Connolly's thoracic surgeon. And he said the following. The declination of the bullet was at a 27-degree downward angle. And again, a downward track. As I say declination, it's a downward track. And it's a downward track. It was in and out bullet wound. Now, why is that important? Unbeknownst to Robert Shaw, the angle from the rooftop of the Dallas County Records building, which has a clear view of Elm Street, no obstructions, but from the rooftop of the Dallas Records building, guess what the declination was of the point of exit from the rooftop to the point of striking Connolly? 27 degrees. So, unless you believe in these coincidences, it might not mean much. But when you're trying a case and you're figuring out what are the objective facts that cannot be refuted, this is a classic one, and it's so overwhelming that you couldn't imagine trying this case without putting on these Parkland doctors. Worse than that even was, this whole thing is an intentional contrivance by the CIA, because the evidence, as I mentioned to you, just here at Dealey Plaza, gives us an incredible view of why witnesses think they were not helpful when they really were, when you put it all together. And that's what makes this thing so interesting. The other issue is this. Something fascinating happened. The forecasters of this case, that is to say all these people who lied about it from the government's point of view, the Warren Commission, the following happened. This is amazing. In December of 63, the Secret Service and the FBI, this is December of 63, the Secret Service and the FBI found that Connolly and Kennedy were struck by two separate bullets, and both were shot within 1.9 seconds of each other. Now, why is that important? Because the manual bolt action, I should say, and necessary to fire separate successive shots. Let me repeat that. The manual bolt action necessary to fire separate successive shots from the alleged murder weapon, the Manuka Carcano rifle, takes 2.3 seconds. So there goes the Manuka Carcano out the window.
Yeah.
If they were hit within 1.9 seconds and you can't get a shot out faster than 2.3 seconds from the rifle, put the rifle aside and figure up your next line. Because now with the absence of the rifle, what do you think the CIA did? They didn't quit. They had this fellow named Arlen Specter, who I'm sure you know about.
Yeah, yeah.
He became the DA of Philadelphia. Here's the kind of politician he was. Sprague was there running the whole office during this period of time. And Specter was directed by the CIA. He was directed by the CIA to create the one bullet theory. And Specter was a staff attorney then. He went on to be the DA. And when he ran for DA in Philadelphia, he was a Democrat. I wonder why. And then when he ran for state senate, guess what he was? A Republican. I wonder why. So that's who we're talking about from the political side of this thing. So the single bullet theory is a clear indication of how pernicious the government has been, because here's why. They decided that they would claim that they had science on their side. You can imagine this claim here. And that's called neutron activation analysis. N as in Nancy, AA. Neutron activation analysis, they said, is there are only two pieces of ballistics in this case. And if you don't believe it, then you're a believer that the world is flat. And here's why. Neutron activation analysis is the principal testing component for comparative bullet-lead analysis. What does all that mean? The comparative bullet-lead analysis was, they claimed at the CIA, that you could match a fragment to a fragment and a fragment to a bullet. The only problem is you can't do it. How do we know that? couple of reasons. The only lab ever to have done this, this is fragment to fragment and fragment to bullet, is that the only lab was in America. And when the FBI found out what I'm about to tell you, because they had many FBI agents who were testifying to this under oath at criminal trials. But the evidence is, when you speak to the metallurgical PhDs of America, they have stated unequivocally, and to the satisfaction of the NAA people, that the NAA is a false, scientific, invalid fabrication. It's a sham.
Oops.
How do we know this, and what did they do? On September 1st, 05, as a result of the 10 experts that they agreed to, the CIA and the FBI, they agreed to this, that these experts would come in and support their position. But what happened, in fact, was the experts said, you cannot match a fragment to a fragment or a fragment to a bullet. Now, keep in mind, this is a lot different from matching a bullet to a pistol because of the infirmities that take place when you make and you manufacture a pistol outside that chamber. When that bullet swirls through the swirls and on and on, that is different from what I'm just saying to you, because in the car, in the limo, were two large fragments that they came from, that the government said, the CIA said, came from the same bullet. That's bullet one. Bullet two was in Connolly's right wrist, which was fractured as a result of the shots that were fired, and I'll explain why, because that came in the fifth bullet, the fifth shot that comes in at 3:28. And the issue here for us is how can it be that this bullet was in such condition as for anyone to make this claim? Now, because they said that, here's the kicker. They said that in CE-399, which is the magic bullet, the pristine, alleged pristine bullet, that bullet was the bullet that was part of the single bullet theory, this nonsense of coming out the throat and so on and so forth. And within that, so they claim that the Connolly fragments match CE-399. The pristine bullet, that's Commission Exhibit 399. Here's what the evidence is. I'm sure you've heard of this. It's called minute metallic fragments.
Robert, hold that thought before we. I don't want to cut that up.
I'm with you.
Let's take a really quick break. We're going to come back. We're doing a terrible job of promoting the book. That Day in Dallas is the name of the book. It comes out May 20th, 2025. Our guest is Robert Tannenbaum. You're listening to We the People, and we will be right back with you. So before we run out of time, Robert, I got to ask you, did you have to wait to release this book until all this stuff was put out, or were you already on schedule to do this a long time ago and you were just doing it no matter what?
You hit it on the head with the latter. I had no idea they were going to release, you know,
no Trump's kidding.
Trump decided in his first term he's not going to release it, which was with the crazy notion that if you saw what I saw, you would not release it either. Well, that's what we want to see.
Yeah, right.
The American people want to see what he saw. That's what we're talking about here. So there was no question in my mind that I was doing my book. And you see when you go through, and I hope you do, that you'll see why I'm saying what I'm saying about all this. And I vividly recreated and it's very critical. Let me get into the minute metallic fragments for a moment, if I may.
Absolutely.
And that is that if someone were to shoot me in the back of the head right now, there would be no minute metallic fragments in the front part of my skull near the temple area, just so we understand what the dynamics here are. And so the minute metallic fragments, they're inside JFK's head, and they're at the right side, ranging from high in the right temple area through the rear region. And what is the significance of all this? There were three skull x-rays, and superimposed on the x-rays is JFK's face, a portion of it. And it's a long, narrow rectangle of the actual range of the shot that hit him in the head. In the rear region, it's through the rear region of his of his head with these minute metallic fragments. So what is their significance? The minute metallic fragments not only tell us the direction of the wound, because you can see these metallic fragments get larger and larger as it goes deeper into his skull. And that's what the x-rays show us. And they're available for people to look at. But what it tells us also is the point of entry of the fourth shot. The CIA has ignored this evidence and lied about it as if it never existed. And out came 0.7 of a second later what I call the fifth shot. And that fifth shot was very important for us to deal with because it comes in frame 328. And I didn't see a flare as I saw in frame 313. That's the shot that hit JFK above the temple area, above his right ear, and blows out the back of his head. And Bobby Hodges, who was in the motorcade, drops his motorcycle. He was right by the Mrs. Kennedy side. He got hit with bone, blood, and brain from the president's head. He runs and drops his motorcycle, runs to the area of the stockade fence where he believed that others believed shots were being fired from. And again, that stockade fence comes from in front of the president, and limo hadn't passed that point yet. That's what's so significant about it all. Anyway, 0.7 of a second later, we come up with frame 328, and that fragment from that goes, that shot, it hit JFK in the cowlick on the top of his head, and we didn't see a flare as you watched the film. And I have all of those exhibits from the film, from the Zapruder film, frame by frame. So I said to my assistant then was Bob Grodin, and he does an introduction to the book on, you know, That Day in Dallas. His name is right below mine on giving an introduction. He says, what are we going to do about that? We don't see the flare, meaning if we saw the flare at impact on 313, we should see a flare here at 328. And so we went frame by frame, and lo and behold, at 328, we went from 313 right to 328 and then beyond, we see the damage to the interior windshield to the left of the rearview mirror inside the limo. We see it at 328. And the fragment did three things. It caused his head to move forward, even though JFK was dead. The impact of the force, keep in mind, JFK's head, not his body, moves his body in this whole sequence. JFK's head responds to the force. So when he was hit from the front right, his head snapped back and to his left. When he's hit at the top of the cowlick, his head, even though he's dead and he's slumped down, bodily depressed and immobile, his head went forward. So people have totally misstated this, that his head really went forward and so on and so on, avoiding the minute metallic fragment issue. And one of the other things that this bullet did, these fragments, it moved his head moved forward, as I said, and it enlarged the wound of the fourth shot. And it showed damage to the interior of the windshield. And then that bullet fragment struck Connolly. This is important. struck Governor Connally in the right wrist, severing his tendon in his right thumb, connecting that to his the tendon in his right thumb, and to his right, and fractured his right wrist. At which point, you'll love this part of it, he drops the Stetson hat. That is, Connally was holding on to his Stetson hat, the white Stetson hat. Throughout all of this shooting, he never drops the Stetson. And the reason why he doesn't drop the Stetson is because the expert handling these fragments from the fifth shot indicated that the Connally wrist issue was so serious a shot that fractured his the nerve in his right wrist so that he could not hold on to anything. It would be as if someone shot me in the shin and I would be unable to stand up. Same kind of effect. But it tells us a lot about what was going on with the shooting that day in Dallas. And those are the overwhelming issues that I think is important for the public to know about, and that's why I did the book. There's no secrets from me in this book. As I said initially, there are things I reveal in this book that I have not revealed to anyone else. They're very personal, but they're very important. They're certainly very important to me.
And what made you decide to do this now?
It's a very personal answer, but I'll tell you. Where are you guys located?
Us and our best friends.
We're in Northern California.
The good part of California. Far away from...
I'm in Southern California. Okay. Well, you guys know that, I'm sure. Okay.
Yeah.
What happened was, I was diagnosed with a very serious number 4 tumor.
Oh.
And my family had this in the family, and my mother had it, and she was in terrible pain, and this happened 60 years ago. And she wants to stay at home for the two years that she had left in her life. And it was to the point where I was giving morphine shots and so on. And my aunt moved in, my mother's younger sister, and took care of everything. It was an amazing woman. It's all in the book, trust me. And I realized that as time went by, I wanted what was being written and said was not true. And I wanted to make sure the truth was out. And my mentor, by the way, Mel Glass, is in Echoes of My Soul. I urge you to read that book. It's nonfiction. If you want to know what goes on in the DA's office and what we lived through with District Attorney Frank Hogan as a legend, believe me, he was greater than legend. He never wavered on doing the right thing, even when it almost cost him his entire career. Echoes of My Soul. I urge you to read that book, nonfiction mm-hmm. book. Anyway, And because it is an echo, you know, it is an echo of my soul, the book. And Mel wanted me to write it. He's a fabulous person. He was my mentor, and I can't say enough good things about him. So I realized that I said I would never take chemo, I'd never take radiation, but I don't want my family to think I just, you know, said goodbye and I just disappeared. So I did. I took that. And the radiation, they gave it to me first, which was atypical in these cases. This was in the colon area. And I never thought anything would happen. I wanted to go through the experience, though, to make sure everybody understood that I was fighting this thing. We don't quit. I don't care what it is. And I spent my life playing ball, believe me. We don't quit. So I had this situation, and then I got... my surgeon, my chemo man, fabulous person. After radiation, we waited 3 months before we gave me chemo because they said I was still cooking, and I was like a prime rib. You know, I said, "What are you gonna put tin foil on me here?"
Yeah, that's not good.
So anyway, what happened was, bottom line to the whole story is he kept asking me, my chemo man, great doctor. And David Hoffman, and he said to me, "What are your symptoms?" I said, "David, you keep asking me the same questions. Please tell me what a symptom is, and then I'll say I have it, and then you'll be happy." He says, "Do you have any pain?" I said, "I have no pain." He said, "This is very strange. I need to have 12 sessions with you on the chemo, but now that we finished 6, and we started in June of, 2020, he said to me, I want you to be reexamined. So I did. I went through the same stuff you normally go through. And he said, he called me into the office the next day. And he said, I must see you. And I said, okay. And again, I didn't do anything special or anything special.
Robert, I hate to do this to you, but now you have to come back. Because
I'm going to come back because I just want to tell you what happened.
Because the news is going to cut us off.
You want me to just tell you what happened on this thing?
Oh, I don't know.
Quickly? Okay, well,
no,
I'll give you a shout out.
We want to force you to come back.
I'm with you.
We're gonna.
I would love to come back to you guys.
Yes.
You have no idea. I'd love to come back.
All right, we're doing it again really soon. I'm calling Kimberly. We're making
Please.
It happen. Robert Tannenbaum, .. The rest of the story to come, because darn it, we ran out of time. I hate time. It's very annoying. I think that's the end of his story, too. The time is annoying.
That Day in Dallas. Pick it up. It's going to be a...
And you can find out about all of it at wethepeopleradio.us.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay. We got minds to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down. We can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Until we close our eyes for good.